I'm very, very thankful that I have this stand here to hold the microphone. Good morning. Is there anyone here who was not here yesterday? Wow. Okay, well, welcome. You missed a great evening. It was the best. It goes downhill from now on, and I'm very sorry. I'm going to do a very brief summary of what I said. Can I be heard? Is this fine? Okay. And here are my pictures, which I guess I could ask you to send back there. Thank you. Forgot to press the button. Okay. I'm just working on my summary. I want to say a few things before I begin, and one is that I really mean it when I say that I'm telling you what I've been taught. It's not as if I am a brilliant analyst of everything. Almost everything I'm going to tell you, except one or two things, are what I was taught and what I learned from reading other people or listening to other people. They're mostly in AA, so I'm giving you an OA version of it, and my experience in OA has allowed me to sort of broaden the scope of what they have said in AA. But really, I don't want to put myself up as a guru, as an expert. I am a student. I am not a role model. I practice what I call a good enough program. It keeps me abstinent. It keeps me happy. I go through cycles up and down. I use the steps to deal with those cycles. I am at a healthy weight. My doctor says so. I am not at a perfect weight. And I don't want, do as I say and not as I do. So I don't want to be put up. I am not in any way, shape, or form a star of any kind. I know my own limitations. I want to emphasize that. And again, for the benefit of those people who were not here yesterday, I am talking about the Big Book and Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous as a set of directions for doing the steps. I found that these directions work. They are guaranteed to work if they're followed, and I have never seen them fail. You will find as we go through the steps that there are certain steps where you have checklists and these documents here. One of the documents here is a checklist of promises, and I use and they're found. Many of the steps have promises, and if you don't feel those promises, you haven't done the step right. So you'll know whether you've done the step right or not by whether or not these promises have come true for you. And when we get to step five, the promises are extremely important because, as you will find out when I talk about step five, if they don't come true, you didn't do step four right. And there's more step four and step five work to be done. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a very good checklist to tell you where you are at any point. I want to start off by reading to you. I'm just going to move this a bit. By reading to you from the first policy motion that was passed by the first business conference of Overeaters Anonymous. Because most of you are not English first language speakers, you might not catch. I don't know. Maybe you can. It is probably the worst written policy statement ever. But it is an important one. It says, we endorse as our only basic creed, the only thing that OA in general subscribes to from headquarters, the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, that this is the only basic program that OA headquarters believes as its creed. We acknowledge that these two things are the only creed that OA subscribes to basically. That's very badly written, but what it means and what it says is that we are a 12-step fellowship, and we are the primary purpose, Tradition 5 tells us. The primary purpose of our fellowship is of every OA group, whether it's this group or whether it's a small group or whether it's the large group of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole, large fellowship, is to carry the message of recovery to those who still suffer. That means, first of all, we have to recover. And second of all, in order to keep our recovery, we have to carry it on and give it to other people. We don't exist to be nice. We don't exist to take care of each other. We exist to carry the message of recovery. And as we go on, you'll see how tough, how clear the Big Book is about that. We're not handholders, even though we hold hands. We're not comforters, even though we comfort. We are not friends, even though we are friendly. We are here to carry the message. And when we gather in the name of Overeaters Anonymous, that's our purpose, to help others who have our problem. And the answer comes through the 12 steps, not through anything else. The tools of recovery, which many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with, are very helpful to keep you abstinent while you're working the steps. But recovery comes from the steps. It does not come from the tools of recovery. If you have a problem, there may be many ways of dealing with that problem, but from our point of view, the solutions come through the 12 steps. And I'll show you as we go along how the Big Book makes that very clear and how it shows us how to handle any problem that we ever encounter using the 12 steps. So that, I just thought I'd read that. What I did yesterday in a longer form, I'll do very shortly today as a summary and to help those who are here for the first time. I told my story, and I told a number of my eating stories to show the existence of what is called, in the doctor's opinion, the phenomenon of craving, the unexplained occurrence of cravings. And a craving is something that we cannot stop with our mind. A craving is the equivalent of the need to blink, the need to drink, the need to breathe, our heart beating. It is something that, although we may think we are masters and mistresses of our own destiny, we are not. We cannot control certain parts of our body. It controls us. And the cravings that the doctor talks about in the doctor's opinion in the first part of the Big Book are exactly the same way. It is the concept that once we start, we cannot stop. At certain times, it's not always true, but at certain times, once we start, we find ourselves unable to stop. And the symbol of that is the hand going to the mouth and continue to bring food, and the mind saying, "I must stop. I have to stop. This is it. I can't go on anymore. I can't stop." That is the phenomenon, the unexplained occurrence of craving. And then the doctor also talks about something else called the mental obsession, which I will talk about this morning. The alcoholic, the drug addict, the gambler, many of the 12-step fellowships all know that when you begin working the steps, you must abstain from an activity, a particular activity, a particular substance. It's taken for granted. You are sober. You are abstinent. You do not ingest or participate in particular activities or foods, put that in reverse order, or substances. The difference between Overeaters Anonymous and most of the 12-step fellowships, not all of them, is that we do not have one particular substance or even a group of substances that we all agree on causes in each one of us the same cravings. And that, as a matter of fact, that's a true fact. It is true that within this fellowship, there are people who get cravings from foods that I can eat, and I get cravings from food that other people can eat. The World Service Business Conference, the Group Conscience of Overeaters Anonymous, adopted in the Dignity of Choice pamphlet the statement that no plan of eating that works for one person necessarily works for another. And it is against the group conscience of OA, therefore, to impose a plan of eating on anyone else. The plan of eating that works for me may not work for you, and vice versa. It may help as a guide, and I'm going to use my plan of eating to tell you how I reached my plan of eating to help you reach yours. But I would never, ever suggest that you adopt mine without checking to see whether it does meet your needs and your cravings. There's a person I know I've met, and I haven't met him. I've met him through email, who is for various reasons, has adopted a plan of eating that is beyond my understanding. I just don't understand it. It is so restricted in its own way. But that's his plan of eating, and I'm not going to tell him that he's wrong, because I don't know if he's right or wrong. The test is whether or not it eliminates the foods and the eating behaviors that cause these phenomena of craving. And normal people don't get them. They don't need them in the same way. They can stop once they've started. They don't have to eat at all. Now, it's not true that all of us at all times always have these cravings. It depends on how far we've gone. You know, I certainly, when I joined OA, I would say that I was worse than I had ever been, that I just could not stop eating at a certain point. And I have eaten, I have eaten huge gallons of ice cream. I've eaten all the popcorn, the buttered popcorn, in, you know, in, well, almost in the cinema. You know, I would make these large buckets. I've eaten, as I told you yesterday, after having a full meal, I've eaten an entire goose skin. I've eaten a great deal. But there are times when pressure, you know, from having other people watch me or something like that has somehow prevented me. My mind has not been able to do it, but the other people looking at me have somehow done it. As well, in my earlier life, there were times when I didn't get these cravings all the time. And the Big Book makes clear as we go on, I'll talk about it this morning, that the issue isn't how often it happens or how much you've had, but whether it has happened to you at all. Because if it has happened to you at all, then you might be one of us. If it's never happened to you, you might not be one of us. There are many people who just eat a lot, and they don't have any cravings that they get. They just eat a lot, and for them, their solution might not be Overeaters Anonymous. It might be some diet program which tells them, oh, so this is all I need to eat. So, you know, I forgot what ounces are, but, you know, 500 grams of meat. Well, I don't know. I don't remember what grams are. I deal, unfortunately. I'm an old person dealing in the English style of measurement. But I just need a hockey puck worth of meat. You know, that's all I need. I don't need to eat the big steak. So that's all it is. And some people just, that's all they need is some guidance on how much to eat. And for them, diets work. Why shouldn't they work? They're not compulsive eaters. So the first issue is cravings. And the first issue is defining our plan of eating. You can't do step one. You can't be on step one. You can't admit your powerlessness until you also eliminate the foods and eating behaviors that cause you the cravings. Now, this is different from what many of us learn in Overeaters Anonymous. We're often given a plan. Follow this. Or we're told, your problem is my problem. You must abstain from these particular ingredients. But that's not what the Big Book says, and it's not what the Dignity of Choice and the Group Conscience of Overeaters Anonymous says. So I'll tell you how I did it, and then I'll tell you how I work with sponsees to do it. And I'm happy at any break to talk with any of you to help you work out your own plan of eating, because I think that that is one of the biggest problems in OA, that we haven't worked out our own individual plan of eating. People relapse in OA, and there are only two reasons for relapse. One is you aren't working the steps, and therefore quickly enough, so therefore you haven't reached that freedom from the bondage of the food. That's a clear one. The other one, though, might really be you're still eating foods that you crave, that cause you cravings, and you don't know it. And you've got to look back at your plan of eating and figure out, what are you still eating that is causing you these problems? Because if you're relapsing, it means either your body is telling you that it needs something, or it wants something, not that it needs it, that it wants something, or your mind is telling you that it's okay to have it. There are only two possibilities. So when sponsees relapse, I always say, okay, let's go over your plan of eating. Let's figure out what, maybe you're eating something that you don't realize is causing you cravings. And I, being a lawyer, I don't know if the word cross-examine means anything to you, but I cross-examine them. And sometimes I've done it myself. I mean, I'll tell you as I go on with my plan of eating. When I first set out my plan of eating, this is 6 or 7 years after I joined OA, after I began to accept the notion, and it was, you know, in the Big Book, as I read from the doctor's opinion yesterday, the writers of the Big Book said In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. We are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. I rejected that. The word allergy to me meant that it caused bad reactions in my body, and I couldn't accept the notion that my love of food and my wish to have more of it was an allergic reaction. But when I studied the meaning of the word allergy, I realized that in fact it was. It was an abnormal physical reaction to a substance. And I had to figure out what that the abnormal reaction was cravings. Not a rash, not diarrhea, but cravings. And I had to examine what I was eating to see what caused me cravings. And I had to do that before I worked the steps, because I had to be honest. So I first listed my binge foods, the foods that I knew I ate too much of. It was not hard for me to figure out what those were. They were the ones I didn't want to give up. They were the ones that I felt, my God, if I give them up for my entire life, I will never enjoy my life. Which is pretty sick when you think about it, but certainly I knew what that meant. And the list was, it was long, but it included, on the dessert side, ice cream, shortbread. Is that do you know shortbread? Shortbread is the answer to the question, how little flour do you need to use to mix butter and sugar together? Shortbread and cheesecake. Those were the three things I absolutely adored. I could eat all kinds of other things, but those three things were the foods that gave me the most enjoyment. Enjoyment may not be the right word, but you know what I mean. On the dessert side. On the other side, it was fried potatoes. It was deep fried foods deep fried chicken. It was goose skin and chicken skin and turkey skin. It was the fat from steaks. It was fatty foods in general. I used to joke that I used to have popcorn on my butter rather than butter on my popcorn. And these were the foods I listed. So clearly I had to give them up because they were foods that caused me cravings. I have eaten in my life more ice cream than any normal person would eat in his or her life. And that's true for most of the foods that were on my list. So I listed those foods, and then I also asked myself, is there a common ingredient in those foods that I should be looking at carefully? And of course, you can see from the list I gave, it's fats. Fats for me, fats mixed with sugar and fats mixed with salt that were my biggest problem. And I developed a plan of eating that restricted the amount of fat I would take in. I knew that dairy fats were absolutely terrible for me. Butter, cream, even high-fat milk, even normal milk, the milk that isn't reduced in fat, sour cream, all kinds of foods that are very high in fat, dairy foods, really have an impact on me. And so I eliminated all of them. The only time I have even 2% milk, I never have 3.5% milk, the only time I have 2% milk is in very small quantities. A cappuccino. I will not have a latte with that. That's too much milk. But a little bit I can take. But that's about the most I can take. I limited myself with other fats and even with some of the dairy fats that you can't get rid of. I worked it out, about 10% of the calories come from fat. That would be the most in any meal I would take. And I would look at the ingredients and the measurement of the ingredients on the labels to make sure that I restricted that. If I had a choice between food that had no fat and food that had some fat, I would always choose the food with no fat. And I would not eat butter or any of those other foods. I chose that as my plan of eating. And I worked the steps, and I worked them hard, and I did steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, and the guarantee of step 9, it happened to me, I no longer wanted to eat the butter, the ice cream, the cakes, the high-fat products. I was freed from that. The thought of eating them nauseated me. The thought of I looked at them as if they were poison. And they were for me. Because I knew if I started to eat them, I could not stop. And I felt this sanity of being able to be around these foods and watch other people eat them and enjoy them. And my happiness that they were enjoying them and no sadness that I couldn't have them, and no interest or curiosity in what they tasted like. This was a freedom I never thought I would ever enjoy in my life. I've had that for over 20 years. It's just an amazing sense of being able to be places and watch other people eat and not want it. That's what's promised by the big book, by the end of step 9. But after 6 months or 3 or 6 months, I had not lost much weight. I was eating very healthy. I was no longer eating the foods that beckoned to me. And it was time for me to sponsor, time for me to make myself available. I wanted to carry the message of the big book as it had been carried to me. And I realized that I was not a role model for anyone coming to the rooms who was looking for someone who had a healthy body weight, who had lost the weight. I could talk about wonderfully about the freedom from the bondage of food, but I could not carry the message well because I didn't look like the message. And so I began to analyze my plan of eating even more. Clearly the problem was volume. I was eating healthy. I was not eating anything that caused me cravings, but clearly I was eating too much food. And I then began to analyze my volume intake and what cravings related to the volume intake. Again, if I'm using words that you don't understand because English is your second language or maybe your third, please let me know and ask me to explain any words. But if I'm making myself clear, that's terrific. And around that time, I was sitting in my dentist's chair. My dentist, he's older now, he's retired, but he was my cousin, and he used to, for me, he would open up at 6:30 or 7 in the morning to do my teeth. So he was working on my teeth, and he said to me, you haven't eaten this morning. And, well, you know how you talk to dentists. I said, he understood. The dentists understand. And I said, yes, I have. And he said, no, you haven't. I said, well, I have. Why do you think that I haven't eaten? He said, because you are salivating. All kinds of saliva is coming, and you only do that if you're hungry. And I began to think, that's not true. I salivated many different times. As a matter of fact, he was working on, I don't know if there's crowns that go over, because I'd broken my teeth. Why had I broken my...
What does salivating mean?
Salivating means... Okay, thank you. I don't know any other way to describe it without being disgusting.
Translated.
Yes, I know she did. I had broken most of my teeth eating bones and eating hard food, and that was another hint. And then I also, in our OA 12 and 12, I happened to come across a passage on pages 2 and 3 of the English version. Like compulsive overeaters, normal eaters will sometimes find pleasure and escape from life's problems in excess food. Compulsive overeaters, however, often have an abnormal reaction when we overindulge. Just this, it's like the big book. We can't quit. That's the abnormal reaction. We can't quit. A normal eater gets full and loses interest in food. We compulsive overeaters crave more. Some of us even have a strange reaction to particular foods. While others can comfortably eat single portions of these foods, we feel compelled to eat another serving after we finish the first, and then another and another. Not all compulsive overeaters can identify particular foods which give us this trouble, but many of us can. What all of us have in common is that our bodies and minds seem to send us signals about food which are quite different from those the normal eater receives. We have found through much experience that no matter how long we abstain from eating compulsively, and no matter how adept, how able we have become at facing life's problems, we will always have these abnormal tendencies. That is, they are physical. Those of us who have returned to our former compulsive eating behaviors, even after years in recovery, have found it harder than ever to stop. Clearly, if we are to live free of the bondage of compulsive eatings, we must abstain from all foods and eating behaviors which cause us problems. So I said, eating behaviors. I will look at my eating behaviors. I identified two eating behaviors that were volume issues with me. Number one, I ate right up to the top of my neck. I had to be completely full. It was healthy food, but I had to be completely full. And the other was just the act of chewing. I loved to chew. That was why I had broken most of my teeth. That was why at times I had to wear a guard in my mouth to keep me from grinding my teeth. It was an issue of chewing. And what I was doing while I was not eating all these, I was abstaining from the foods that I knew were my problem and the ingredients, I was doing what my former diet plan used to suggest, which was eating carrots and celery and no-calorie foods to keep my mouth busy. Chewing gum to keep my mouth busy, for instance. Well, what that did was create more saliva, which created more need to eat. And so I eliminated eating between meals. That was a huge difference. I do not chew or eat between meals. Or suck, either. And I eliminated that. And I also found a way to stop from eating up to the top of my neck. I decided I would stop eating when I felt full up to my navel, my belly button. Does that translates? Now, I know, I just found out about 3 years ago from a nurse that my stomach starts at the belly button, it doesn't end there. But it made sense to me. I knew what it meant. And at a certain point, I get a feeling of fullness, and I stop. And I don't eat all the way up to my neck. And then I lost weight. I over the years I've added more food. I've discovered more food that was a problem. I used to make popcorn without any butter or without any oil. It was like hot air popcorn, and I would eat that, and that was legal. It's a healthy food, lots of fiber. I would eat it as one of my three meals a day, with nothing in between. But I found myself eating it all. And a very experienced person in OA, a friend of mine, said to me that he found that whenever he ate it all, he had to give it all up. And so I gave popcorn up. No problem. As soon as I realized that it was poison for me, I no longer wanted it. And that's happened to me over the years. I discovered, it's a wonderful recipe. You take frozen blueberries, and you take yogurt, skim milk yogurt, no fat in it. You put it in a blender, and you have something that is like ice cream. And I discovered it's too much like ice cream. Even though it's completely healthy for me, I couldn't eat it because I wanted more of it. Because it wasn't, the ice cream combines, ice cream together is fat and sugar, plus this creamy coldness that I seem to love, even if I don't get it from the fat and the sugar. So I had to give up that. I can eat blueberries, frozen blueberries, in yogurt, but as soon as it's blended and becomes like ice cream, I can't eat it. And I've discovered all kinds of foods like that. So I look at my eating behaviors, and I look at similarities to other substances, and I eliminate them as soon as I need them. And I was talking to someone yesterday about perfectionism. In your plan of eating, my own criterion when I work with sponsees is honesty. It's not perfectionism. Are you eliminating everything you know causes you problems? Are you secretly hanging on to something? Because if you're secretly hanging on to something, how can you be honest? And you can't. If you can't be honest, you can't work the steps. The steps require honesty. But once you work the steps, once you eliminate everything that you know causes your problems, that you know today cause your problems, you work the steps, then you will be sane enough to figure out if anything else comes along to cause your problems. And for me, that's the very practical way that it has worked, and it has worked for people whom I know in this program. So what I do with sponsees is very simple. I ask them to list the foods that they know are problems for them. And they do. And they do it with some fear and some resentment because they really don't want to list all the foods that cause problems, but they list the problems. And we start off, and I say, and I ask them, are there any eating behaviors you have that you know are not good for you? And many of them will say yes, watching television and eating at the same time, or reading and eating, or eating after 8 o'clock at night, or 20 hours. That these are problems that they have. Chewing a lot. They'll isolate those eating behaviors. And they'll give foods. And then we look to see whether there are some common ingredients in those foods. And if there are, then we talk about ways in which they can eliminate or restrict those ingredients, depending on what those ingredients are and what kind of themes that there are. And then we develop a plan of eating, and they start it. Now, that sounds simple. It's not always all that simple. But I've met many people over the years. I have a very good friend who says to me, Laurie, I am a volume addict. That's my problem, is eating behaviors. It's not, there are no particular foods. As a matter of fact, this particular friend of mine has real restrictions on the kinds of foods he can eat because of a problem he has with his digestive system. So he has already eliminated a lot of foods that he can't eat. Not because of OA, but he just can't eat them. Just as people who may have gluten allergies they can't eat gluten. But that doesn't mean that it causes them cravings. It means it actually causes them nausea. They don't eat it because it's not good for them. It has nothing to do with their plan of eating for OA. It has everything to do with a healthy eating healthy. If the products that have gluten call to them, that's another issue. But most people who have gluten allergies don't want to eat gluten because it causes them problems. At any rate, so he's already eliminated many of the foods. But his problem is volume. And what he says to me is, I don't have a belly button that I can measure from. I can't do it that easily. I have to weigh or measure my food, because that's the only way I'll know whether I'm taking in the right amount and not too much. That seems reasonable to me. If you don't know where your belly button is, or you don't know any other way to restrict your volumes, weighing and measuring sounds like it's a good idea. And so I pass judgment on no one, but it seems to me reasonable to do that. I've been able to do it by without weighing and measuring, although I weigh one thing I weigh, just because I haven't been able to figure out where my belly button is in relation to that one product. I don't weigh, I measure it. And as I get older, as my metabolism changes, I may have to weigh and measure more foods. Big deal. It's no problem. The main thing is that if one of my cravings is volume, if I can't restrict my volume, if I must restrict my volume because I don't know when I've had enough, I have to find a way of doing that. And weighing and measuring is one way of doing that. I know people, good friends of mine, who don't say what they can't eat. They say what they can eat. They have a list of foods that they can eat. And of course, that list eliminates all the foods they can't eat, so it's fine, But they like to have a more restricted a group of things that they allow themselves to eat. It makes it easier for them. Terrific. There's just no magic to this. But the main question is whether you really are eliminating the foods that cause you craving, or the food ingredients or the eating behaviors that cause you cravings. I've met a lot of people who have admitted to me, and some who haven't admitted to me, who have not eliminated the foods. They've taken someone else's plan and said, this is the right one for me, without really thinking about whether it is the right one for me. In a way, there's a lot of sugar and flour addiction concept. I know that there is in this room, and I'm not suggesting that there isn't a sugar and flour addiction concept. But I have noticed among some people that those who say that they are sugar and flour addicted have not lost weight and continue to keep at a high level, because what they think is a sugar and flour problem really is a sugar and fat problem with flour mixed in. If you ask them, I was once challenged by a person, I've been abstinent for 11 years and I haven't lost any weight. What do you say to that? And I said, okay, well, what have you abstained from? Sugar. Haven't had sugar for 11 years. And I said, well, let me try a little experiment. I would like to, let's imagine that I have a large bag of sugar, and I put it in front of you, and I have a spoon, and I force you to eat 3 spoonfuls of sugar. Would that cause you to want the whole bag? And her answer was no. Now, I know people have said yes to that. So I just wanted to say that there are some people who would say yes to that. So I'm just talking about this particular woman. She said, no, I couldn't do that. So I said, well, name me some foods that are your trigger foods. And she said, donuts. I said, okay, well, there is another ingredient in donuts. She said, oh, yes, flour. I should be eliminating flour. So I said, okay, let's imagine that I put a bag of flour in front of you, and I force you to eat 3 tablespoons of flour. Would that cause you cravings, and would you want to eat the whole bag? She said, no, I couldn't eat the bag at all. I said, well, there is another ingredient in donuts. And she said, what? I said, donuts are deep fried fat. You know, they're fat in the donuts, and then you deep fry them. So maybe the problem is fat and sugar. And she walked away. You know, and I can only imagine that she walked away only to say, well, I'm going to abstain from sugar. I've been to OA conventions where people have, you know, the people who ordered the food for the convention, I'll never forget this one. They ordered chicken Kiev. Well, that's the one with the butter in the middle, you know. And do you know what I'm talking about? It's supposed to be a European dish, but it's really an American invention, I guess. I don't know. But it's a chicken that's in batter, two chicken breasts, and in the middle is a huge piece of butter. And you bake it in the oven. It's battered, and you bake it in the oven. And so the waiters were coming to the table with the dinner rolls, the bread, and they would say, oh, don't even bring it to the table. I can't eat any bread. You know, I don't eat flour. And is there sweetener on the table? I need the sweetener. I can't eat the sugar. And then they got this chicken Kiev, and they put their knife into the middle of it, and the butter filled the bowl of the plate. And they ate it all. And their potatoes came. Their baked potatoes come. You know, does the salad have croutons? I can't have croutons in my salad, you know, because I can't eat flour. And then they would have the potato, and then they'd put the butter in the potato, and they'd put the sour cream in the potatoes and the bacon bits in the potatoes. This is American eating. And they had not lost any weight. They had been abstinent for many, many years. And I thought to myself, have they really thought about what their problems are? You know, is it enough to eliminate certain foods that other people say you should eliminate because sugar and flour are the big thing in many different parts of OA? Without really thinking through what causes your problems. So I only question that. I don't say that everyone has a fat addiction. I do, and I've met a lot of people who do, and who have thanked me and cursed me at the same time for pointing that out, because they don't like to admit that that's their problem. But many of them have found, like me, that they have a fat and sugar and fat and salt addiction, which is difficult because there's fat in a great deal of foods. So I only point those out, and I'd be happy to cross-examine any of you about your food, about your plan of eating. I'm not going to go much farther than that. I had something interesting to say. I can't remember what it was, so we'll go on. The doctor's opinion. I think I've read everything. I just want to point out on page XXX of the fourth edition of the Big Book, or XXVII of the third edition, or page 24 of the Danish edition, the doctor has talked about different types of alcoholics, and he lists a whole bunch: the manic depressive, about whom a whole chapter could be written, the person who lies to himself, the normal people, and he says, All these and many others have one symptom in common, really only one symptom in common. All the rest, they're so different in types. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon. Again, a phenomenon is an unexplained occurrence, the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation, the symptom of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated, permanently gotten rid of. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. This paragraph is very important in the history of Overeaters Anonymous. After 1 or 2 years of existence, Overeaters Anonymous really had just a couple of diet plans that they had taken from other diet programs, other suggested diets. And Roseanne, the founder of Overeaters Anonymous, went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, an open Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and heard this paragraph being read, and realized that OA did not have the equivalence of sobriety that AA had. It didn't have that. It just had diets. So she wrote a letter to all the groups and said, clearly we have to abstain from compulsive eating. This is the same thing as sobriety in AA is abstinence in OA. And she suggested 3 meals a day, eating nothing in between, which where we get our well-known 301, 3 meals a day, nothing in between, a day at a time. This met with a great deal of resistance from some of the other people who had other kinds of diets. You can read all about it in her book, Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. But it's a very important paragraph, and the doctor's opinion had a major influence on OA. Something I need to say. Well, that's what happens when you don't have a script. It'll come to me. Yes. You'll find on page 24 of the Danish version, on page XXX of the 4th edition, XXVIII of the 3rd edition. It says, all these and many others have one symptom in common. It would be at the beginning of page 24 of the Danish version, I think, or very close to the beginning. No, I would. I'm asked if I want to ask questions as they occur. With this many people, it means I won't have time.
Okay, so
that's what the ask it basket is for.
Okay.
Because if you have a question, almost certainly everyone, there are 5 other people in the room who have a question. Okay. Okay, it'll come to me. I'm going to. Is the coffee ready? Is it time to take a short break then? Or I'm just looking at the people. If you could just see if it's time for to take a short break.
3 minutes.
Okay, well, I'll go on a bit. We now begin the big book proper. The doctor's opinion used to be page 1 of the big book in the original edition. It was moved into the introductory material in the English version. It's still on page. It's close to page 1 in the Danish edition, and maybe in all the others. But in the English edition, it was in the introductions, and people stopped reading it. One of the important things that Joe and Charlie, the AA speakers, did was we resurrect the doctor's opinion. I'm not sure it's that important for members of AA because they know they can't drink alcohol. But in OA, we need to read this because we need to accept the concept that it is physical. I know what I want to say. There are studies done now on what creates cravings. There was a book written by a New York Times reporter about how all the fast food companies, the McDonald's and the Kentucky Fried Chicken, measure so carefully the amount, the mixture of salt and fat and sugar to create the cravings and the feeling of ease and comfort that people get in order to encourage them to eat more. There are some studies done, and I don't want to... I don't have a medical degree, and I can't pass a medical. I can't give you any medical opinion, but certainly the concept that we get serotonin or dopamine or some pleasure-enhancing drug because of our bodies from foods, as alcoholics might get from alcohol, as drug addicts might get from drugs, is an interesting concept. That our bodies are wired to this extent that food does react to us in different ways. That we react to foods in different ways from normal people who don't get that. We know that any person who has been overweight and loses the weight still has the number of fat cells that he or she had when that person was bigger. And so I have more fat cells than anyone who has always been my weight. And those fat cells are empty of fat, or basically empty of fat, and they probably want it, you know. Whereas the normal person does not have as many fat cells and doesn't have the same draw. So that there is probably something physical, but it's unique to every person. And because of that, there will be no way to do research on it to prove that it exists in every person, because different foods do different things to us. The other thing is that eating behaviors, people might say, well, those are eating behaviors. They're things that you can change by habit. I can't. I'm sure that if I had 30 years of psychoanalysis, I could not change the need to be full right up to my neck. I'm sure I could not change the need to chew all the time. I simply have to abstain from doing that and then work the steps to keep my mind from sending me back there. Okay, are we ready now, Marlene? Is it ready to take a break? Okay, so we'll take a break now and we'll come back.